6209. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2005 lecture series presents Troubled Waters and a Globalizing World, Community, Property, and Conflict Over a Vital Resource by Amita Bhaviskar, University of Delhi, India, on Thursday, November 4th at 7:30 p.m. at the U of I's Levis Faculty Center.
The following is a test of the emergency alert system.
Monthly test of the broadcast stations of your area. Stations are participating in a required monthly test of the emergency alert system. The system was developed to provide information to the public during an emergency. This has been a test.
This is AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and at the controls, Henry Frain. Tomorrow night, President Bush will be giving his State of the Union address, and it is widely expected that a major focus of his talk will be Social Security. For some time now, the president has been saying that he feels the Social Security system is in crisis. He has used that word many times, and says that if the problems of the system are not addressed, it will be flat broke by the time today's young workers are ready to retire. Not everyone sees it this way. Others, including the actuaries of Social Security, say there is no real crisis today. They say the system is fully capable of paying full benefits through the year 2042, and after that point, perhaps some changes will be needed, but they question the use of the word crisis. This morning, we will return to this subject and discuss it once again with our guest, Mark Weisbrot. He's an economist. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He writes a weekly column on economic and policy issues that is distributed to over 550 newspapers around the country. He's also contributed opinion pieces to the Washington Post, the L.A. Times, the Boston Globe, and other papers, has been interviewed widely on national television and radio. He is also the co-author of a book that will tell you where he's coming from on the issue. He co-authored this book along with Dean Baker. The title is Social Security, the Phony Crisis. It was published by the University of Chicago Press in the year 2000, and also has written, Mark has written a lot of research papers dealing with economic policy. If you're interested, by the way, in finding out more about him and about the center, they do have a website, www.cepr.net, so you can go there. Also, this morning, as we talk, questions and comments are welcome. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and a toll-free, 800-222-9455. Hello, Mark. How you doing?
Okay. How you doing, David?
I'm fine. Thanks. Thanks very much for talking with us once again. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let me ask you just again to start and give you a chance to give your view on Social Security. It does certainly, for some time, the president did use the word crisis. He apparently has backed off on that somewhat, talking now about the problem of Social Security, not so much the crisis, perhaps because so many people have responded to that crisis word by saying, well, no, in fact, that it's not. It's not a crisis. Even the Social Security actuary says, no, it's not a crisis. And has even questioned the president's assertion, this sort of flat-out assertion that if we don't do anything, that by the time today's young workers are ready to retire, the system will be broke, which clearly is not the case. How would you characterize the problems of Social Security, or would you even, in fact, say that it had Social Security had problems?
Well, there's a small problem that's no different from what we've had in the past. What you've had is, you know, throughout the 20th century, life expectancy went up, and so we had to decide periodically how much of that longer life we were going to spend in retirement and how we're going to pay for it. So in the 1950s and 60s and 70s and 80s, we raised the payroll tax for Social Security. And we haven't had to raise it since 83 because that was a big one. We also cut benefits in 83. So all that's going on is people are living longer. It's no news here at all. So, yeah, the whole thing is really just manufactured. We're living longer. We've always been living longer. It has nothing to do really or very little to do with the baby boom generation because they're going to be, most of the baby boomers will be dead before there's a shortfall, according to the numbers that the president is using. So it really is, there's nothing here that hasn't always been here. It's a small problem, and I wouldn't even call it a problem that we're living longer. And it's not something that's going to be decided by us now for all future generations. So the system can pay all promised benefits for the next 38 years, according to the numbers that President Bush is using, and even longer if you take Congress's estimate, the CBO, it's the next 48 years, nearly half a century. And even after that, it doesn't run out of money. It never runs out of money because it has the payroll tax. So let's say we were to do nothing for the next, say, 38 years, and according to the president's numbers, we'd be Social Security would be insolvent in 2042. It would still be able to pay a benefit that's higher than what workers receive today, and it would pay a higher benefit, even again, never doing anything, which isn't going to happen, but just assume the worst case scenario. It would pay a higher benefit than what workers would get under the reform plan number two, which is the one that President Bush has pointed to as a possible proposal for his privatization and benefit cuts. So in other words, there's really no scenario under the current program that would be worse than what the president is proposing in terms of actual benefits.
What, one of the things that he's been talking about now for a long time is the private accounts. Although there, I think he's actually even, they're looking for different language to use because apparently people have responded somewhat negatively to the idea of privatization. So they're talking about personal accounts or they've got some kind of different name they're going to put on it. But essentially, it's the kind of thing that he's been talking about now for the last 5 years. And that is that for younger workers coming into the system, they would be allowed to take some of the money that would have gone just straight into Social Security, and with some kind of restrictions, put that into an account, a kind of a personal investment account. Some people have said, well, if we're concerned about not having enough money to pay out benefits, this isn't going to help because it's taking money out of the system. Is it? Do you think actually bad for Social Security, or do you think that it's not a good idea for other reasons?
Well, it's bad for Social Security, and it's not a good idea for other reasons. As you mentioned, it would create about $2 trillion over the next decade or so that the federal government would have to borrow from other sources currently getting from Social Security. So that's a problem. But, you know, the biggest part of this is not for most workers, and I think the press has not reported this very well, and they're always talking about individual accounts, and you see these polls and they ask people, well, would you like to have the option of having some of your money go in an individual account? Of course, you know, half people say yes. I mean, why not, right? Because there's no, doesn't seem like any cost to that. But the plan that the president has referred to from the president's commission, there was a commission set up a couple of years ago called the President's Commission to Strengthen Social Security. And in spite of the name, it was composed only, unlike other presidential commissions on the subject, it was composed only of people who favored these individual accounts or privatization. And so the president has not announced a specific plan, but he's pointed to the reform plan 2 of this commission. And that plan proposes very serious benefit cuts. A typical workers, say 20 years old, now entering the labor force, would lose more than a third of their benefits as compared to the current program, which is quite a bit. I mean, $152,000 over the lifetime of the retirement. And so this is probably the most important part of his proposal. And the White House has admitted that there are going to be benefit cuts. So I would say that's front and center what the president is proposing. And secondarily, he's also proposing to create these individual accounts, which would enable the worker to get about a third of that cut, maybe $50,000 back, if they don't happen to retire at a bad time, like, you know, say what we had in 2000 to 2002, where the stock market declined by 40%. So the accounts, you know, they're bad for a whole bunch of reasons. They add risk. They don't give you much of a return, really, that's anyway significantly higher than what, you know, the trust fund gets on its bonds. And that's because according to the trustees' assumptions, the economy isn't going to grow very fast over the next 75 years. In fact, they're projecting that it'll grow about half the rate that it's grown in the past. And so if you accept their assumptions, and you have to, otherwise there's no Social Security shortfall at all, then you have to ask, well, how can they get the 6.5% rate of return or 7% rate of return that proponents of these individual accounts are claiming that they would get? And the answer is they can't. And there's a nice column in today's New York Times by Paul Krugman, and he actually cited us and what we have on our website. It's called the No Economist Left Behind Test. And the test is a challenge to any economist or anyone else to just write down what they think the returns are going to be, the capital gains and the dividends, returns to stocks over the next 75 years, and make that add up to 6.5%, and also make it consistent with the trustees' projections for economic growth. And that's something that no one's been able to do.
We have several callers. Why don't we go ahead and bring them into the conversation again? Let me introduce our guest, Mark Weisbrot. He's an economist. He's co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. And we're talking about Social Security. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And we have several callers here in line, ready to go. First off is someone listening in Indiana, line number 4. Hello.
Thanks for letting me know. There's a lot on, so I'll cut it right to the first question I was going to ask. What's going on then with the Republicans and or the president and who's ever advising him on this? In a sense, it's almost a redoing of the Iraq War. A lot of flutter and no conceptions of what happens later on. And, you know, that's in the real world, and that's what happened. And this, I remember when this all started, you know, it was like the privatization thing. It was really big on the news. Now it's sort of, you know, it's come down off the cusp and things are starting to splinter. What was the original idea? To help the investment people or some special friends or just what? Or even does it make economic sense to ask that question?
Well, now you're asking for my opinion. I mean, so far I've just been giving you the facts. In my opinion, I would say first, the Republicans have never really liked Social Security, or at least conservatives in the Republican Party have never liked Social Security very much. And so they've always, they voted against it back in 1935. Barry Goldwater attacked it in 1964. And there's a whole history of this, although it's usually been disastrous for them to oppose it. And I think what happened is about 15 years ago, people who didn't like Social Security from the beginning changed their strategy. Instead of attacking it as socialism or ideologically something that's not American as they did in the past, they created this kind of big lie that Social Security was going to go broke. And they managed to convince over the last 15 years probably the majority of the population of this idea, even though there was no basis for it, in fact, and still isn't. And so I think, we wouldn't really be having this conversation if they hadn't succeeded in doing that, because on that basis, then the president can come forward in 2005 you know, with most of the country, or at least half the country, convinced that they're not even going to see their benefits. Then he can come and say, well, let's privatize this thing. And, yeah, I think a big part of the motivation has to come from the major financial contributors who, you know, could conceivably make billions and even tens of billions of dollars with the right kind of privatization.
All right, let's go to next caller, and this is someone listening in Des Plaines up in the Chicago area. Line one, hello.
Yes, hi.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, I've heard considerable talk about Social Security changes and their impact. I don't believe I've heard of any consideration being given to what is the minimum amount of quarters of coverage, I think 10 years of work and 40 quarters of coverage. And I don't know if that's ever been looked at since the creation of the program. Is that being looked at, and would you have even the vaguest idea how much of a saving that would be if we up that to 44 or 48 or some number down the line, and what kind of cost saving that might be? Could you take a guess at that or fill me in on it?
Sure. I don't know how much that would save, but it would kind of it would come at the expense of probably lower-income workers and women especially who have less time in the labor force generally because of caring for children. So I don't know that that would be a—I mean, I would tend to be against that kind of a change.
Mm-hmm. And how is the problem with Social Security and the deficit somehow entwined? I guess I'm unclear about that.
Well, yeah, that has been a big confusion. I think that's one of the tricks that has been used to, and this is there's more of this on our website if you want to read more about it at cepr.net. But basically, what the opponents of Social Security have done is to say, well, all this money that's been saved up, you know, Social Security is running a surplus now and has been since 1983. It's been running a surplus, and that surplus is invested in U.S. Treasury obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Because by law, the trust fund is not allowed to invest in any private financial instruments.
Okay.
So, but these are as good as any other bonds held by the Chinese government or the Japanese government or Bill Gates or anyone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to try and make it look like Social Security has a problem, what they've said is, oh, all this money's been spent, and therefore they don't have anything but pieces of paper. And you see this every day, and you hear it on the radio constantly.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just kind of a trick. You know, it's like saying to you, well, if you buy a government bond and they go and spend the money, that your money's gone. You know, mm-hmm. Clearly that money is not gone. You've got the bond, you get the interest, and you get the principal, and that's exactly what's true in the case of Social Security. There's $1.6 trillion sitting in the trust fund right now, and it's going to grow to over $3.6 trillion in today's dollars. It's adjusted for inflation by 2018. So you hear a lot of these people saying, well, 2018, and very often on the news you hear that 2018 Social Security payroll taxes won't cover benefits. Well, guess what? You know, that doesn't matter at all. It is nonsensical to say that 2018 has anything to do with Social Security. It won't mean anything for Social Security because, you know, it's kind of like saying Bill Gates would be in trouble if he lost his, if he, you know, he decided to work part-time and lost his employment, part of his employment income, because, you know, he'd still have over $40 billion in assets.
Mm-hmm.
And these assets are as good as the $10 bill in your pocket. They're going to be paid. And so that's the relationship. The relationship is that the Social Security system has been running this annual surplus, and it's been saving this money, accumulating it for the baby boomers' retirement, and it's holding it in the form of U.S. Treasury obligations. And so when the time comes that it needs to first draw on the interest, and then draw on the principal itself, that's what it will do. And that's why it can go all the way to 2042, or what I would consider more reasonable projections from the Congressional Budget Office, 2052, without any changes at all.
And who was in power when they allowed Social Security surplus to influence the true amount of the deficit?
Well, see, now you're talking about, that's just a reporting problem. I mean, the government publishes both numbers regularly. So in other words, you can look at the deficit today, and if you look at the number that's published, you know, say last week in the New York Times, when the White House announced their projections for the federal budget deficit, they said it was $427 billion. Well, that's one way of looking at the deficit. I think the better way to look at it would be to include the money that's being borrowed from Social Security, which is another, $173 billion. So then the deficit would be more like $600 billion. That's a better measure of the deficit for purposes of what the government is borrowing. But the press has chosen to report the lower number as though and you understand why they do. It's because they're thinking of it as, well, this is revenue also, so why not just count it as revenue rather than borrowing? But it's not really. It is borrowing, you see. So I think it would be better if the press reported both numbers, or even focused on the bigger number, because that will have to be paid back. But it's not a question of the government. Well, the government, obviously, people in government have to cooperate with that. But it really is, I think, the press's responsibility to report both of those numbers and to explain to people that the government is borrowing, the Treasury is borrowing from Social Security every year, and that will have to be paid back, just like the debts to foreign governments.
Understood. Thank you very much.
All right,
sure.
Thank you. We are just about at our midpoint here, and we have other callers. And let me just introduce again our guest, Mark Weisbrot. He is an economist. He is currently the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., where they do research on a variety of economic issues, Social Security among them. If you're interested in the center, and some of the papers that they've done and some of the information they've put out on Social Security. You also could read some recent columns by our guest, and his columns are distributed to something like 550 newspapers around the country. You can go to the website of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, which is www.cepr.net. And also questions here, further questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Just for a second here, and I promise the callers will get back to them, I do want to have you talk a little bit about what the Bush administration is apparently thinking about in terms of changing the way that benefits in the future would be calculated. As we have discussed, a lot of the conversation so far, what the administration has talked about so far, is the private accounts or the personal accounts or whatever you want to call them, that would actually take money out of the system. So if what we're concerned is being able to meet the future payouts, that's not going to help. Apparently, what the administration is thinking about doing is changing the way the payout is calculated so that it, in effect, would be lower, moving away from making your calculation based on wages to a calculation based on prices. And the theory goes is that wages go up faster than prices. So if you change the basis for your calculation, then your future benefits are actually going to be less. So in the long run, they would say, well, this is going to save us money because we're going to be paying out less money. Do I have that right?
You have it exactly right. And it's turns out to be that's where the big benefit cut that I described, the one third of benefits for someone, you know, 20 years old entering the labor force now, that's where that comes from.
This is something that there has been discussion of in the media. I don't think the administration has come right out and said this is what we're thinking about doing. And I guess we can wait and see what the president says tomorrow, because, again, it seems that everything that I've seen coming out of the administration sort of officially has been about the personal accounts. What do you think the likelihood of the administration now saying, OK, well, in addition to the personal accounts, we're going to do this?
Well, they have acknowledged, you know, it was a couple of months ago. It took them a while, but they did acknowledge that there would be benefit cuts. Hmm. So are they going to put the specific cuts in a plan on the table? I don't know. You know, it's kind of a hot potato. I think what they want to do is they'd like to have some members of Congress put it out there for them, but it's not clear that those folks want to do it either. They're looking to the president for cover. So I don't know who's going to do what, or if they'll end up withdrawing the whole idea altogether. I mean, it is a big political risk for them. And if I had to bet, I would say they will probably lose, because this is a program that, you know, nearly one-sixth of the country draws benefits from. It covers not only the elderly, but survivors, disabled, children. It covers more children than the whole reformed welfare program covers, for example. Mm-hmm. And, 60% of the elderly, more than 60%, get most of their income from Social Security. Now, they wouldn't be directly affected if you're already retired. But if you talk to people who are retired and receiving Social Security, they're pretty protective of the system overall. They don't want to see a return to the days when, not that long ago, as recently as 1959, you had 35% of the elderly in poverty, and now it's less than 10%, mainly because of Social Security. So it's a very popular program. It's been very effective, and there's no reason to do anything like this. At least nobody's put forth an economic reason to do it or a good political reason.
Well, let's talk with some other folks who are listening, and we'll go next to someone in Urbana, line number two. Hello.
Actually, as I was listening to it, I have another comment, but what occurred to me is that this is sort of similar to what happened to when we had corporations. This company over here had a huge retirement fund, and all of a sudden another corporation would buy them out and get at their retirement funds. And I look at it sort of a similar thing, is that they're all of a sudden looking at a way, how can we get this money, or we don't have to particularly pay it back. But actually, what I'd like to have you comment that and give some insight into, under a broader view of Social Security, not only retirement but also health care benefits, congressional members, from my understanding, and their spouses do extremely well. They're probably one of the best programs. We also have Bush, who is worth reported more than $30 million. His future benefits are priceless. So do they get really tremendous benefits? The government does.
Would you? Yeah.
There's some big numbers, aren't there, or not?
I can't remember how much offhand how much members of Congress get, but I think it is a pretty good retirement benefit.
And also, superior health care, and all of a sudden, and even government employees have, from my understanding, great programs. So, nobody's actually talked about that issue. I haven't heard anybody where they want to take theirs away, So anyway, but that's my comment. So.
All right. And Mark, anything else you want to follow up on that with?
No, healthcare is another issue, and I think there you really do have a crisis, because the costs of healthcare are rising so fast, and we pay so much more than any other developed country that's really not sustainable. I mean, that if you look 50 years down the road, you do see an explosion. You see, scenarios of the majority of the country's income going to health care, even, which is not going to happen. There's going to have to be some health care reform. So that's another one of the things that's often mixed in with Social Security, too. People say, try and throw Medicare in there with Social Security and say there's a problem.
All right, let's go on. We'll talk with someone else. And the next caller is in Danville, line number four. Hello.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions. Number one, Mark, you said something about that we have borrowed money from Social Security.
Yes, the federal government borrows money from Social Security each year as it takes in more. The Social Security Trust Fund takes in more than it's paying out in benefits.
Okay. Do you know how much that is? What the debt is, so to speak?
Sure. It's what the Social Security Trust Fund is holding right now. It's about $1.6
trillion. Oh, really? Okay. That was my first question. The second question, and it's really interesting, I never hear anyone ever ask this question in any of the debates, and that is, what is the load difference between taking our money, putting it into a private system versus, working with the people's money, the people themselves? What's the load difference between those two?
What do you mean?
In other words, what's the cost factor of maintaining that money, administrating it, and so forth?
Oh, yeah, the administrative costs are quite high. And even in the lowest cost system, which is the reform plan number two that I referred to, that the president has pointed to as a possible plan that he would propose, that the administrative costs there are about 10 times as much as the administrative costs of the current system. And that's the low end. It could go much, much higher than that. In the countries where you've seen privatization take place, like England or Chile, it's been more than 30 times as much, 30 to 50 times as much as the current system.
That's interesting. And I thought that was the case, but it's really fascinating that you never hear of that as being an argument. You know, people talk about a lot of the emotional issues, but they never get down to the nitty-gritty saying, okay, let's look at the bottom line here, folks. So when people invest money, when you go to a broker or anybody else, that's one of the things you look at is, okay, what's this going to cost me? And there doesn't seem to be much discussion on that. I'm just kind of curious. Thank you.
All
sure.
Right. Thanks you for the call. And we, again, we'll continue. The next is in, I believe, in Champaign, line three. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
The deductions for Social Security are on, I believe, what, the first $75,000 of income or something of that sort?
It's $90,000 this year.
Oh. Well, I have a question. We have a society that is producing millionaires at a greater rate than average person's income is going up. In fact, personal income's almost been stagnant. Why don't we tax and say the first $250,000 or perhaps even the first million and then reduce the rate of the withholding tax? It seems to me we would probably bring in a great deal more money and be less of a burden on the lower income bracket people.
Sure. I mean, many people have proposed just raising the cap to the cap that you referred to on Social mm-hmm. Security income that's taxed, and income that's taxed for Social Security, from the current $90,000 to, say, $140,000 even. Or it wouldn't be hard, and that would take care of most of the shortfall that could appear over the next 75 years. So it is pretty easy to do that. And in fact, it's interesting because, you know, back in 1983 when they had the Greenspan Commission, they made the changes that they made at the time. They expected it to be solvent for 75 years from there. And the only reason it didn't turn out that way is because they didn't anticipate the low wage growth and the redistribution of income that was going to take place since 1983. And so that's really the reason for the shortfall that we're looking at, is simply that more and more income over the past 20 years has gone to people making over $90,000 a year, or $87,000, you know, last year was the limit, whatever the cap is. There's more people over that cap, more income over that cap that doesn't get taxed. So that's one of the most obvious solutions, just to restore it to what it used to be, where the payroll tax covered about 90% of payroll income, and now it's only about 85%, and that difference is quite large.
It may be that I'm just an old progressive and unduly suspicious of conservatives, but it seems to me that this whole business is just a first step toward eliminating a program they've always hated, that they feel insecurity is good for the average person, even though it's apparently not good for very wealthy people.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, I've been on a lot of these radio shows and TV shows, and very often the people on the other side are people who are just ideologically opposed to Social Security. They just don't believe it. They would like to privatize the whole thing. And this is just the first step. And I don't think it's unreasonable to look at it that way.
Well, thank you. I'm glad you wrote the book.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. We'll continue. And the next caller is in Champaign in line one. Hello.
Hello, Professor. I have African-American relatives who live in a poor state in the southern part of the country, and they all benefit from one, either retirement Social Security, disability Social Security, or widow's benefits Social Security, which I guess is the life insurance component of Social Security. And without that, they all would be in dire straits. My question to you, based on that background, is what validity, if any, is George Bush's recent statement to a group of African-American leaders that Social Security really shortchanges African-Americans because, one, we have a shorter life expectancy?
Well, that is a very false and misleading statement. It's actuarially false because, as you mentioned, a lot of African-Americans get disability and survivors benefits as well as the retirees benefits. So even with the short life expectancy, they get at least as much as the rest of the country from the program even currently. But to me, the most outrageous part of that argument, we're talking about a program that's not going to be in place for another 40, 50 years. And so when the president makes that argument, he's basically saying that we're just going to accept for the indefinite future that this terrible disparity of life expectancy between black and white people in this country is going to remain. And that, to me, seems just incredible in the richest country in the world. And we have to, I mean, it's already a scandal, and it should be at least a scandal, that we have this kind of disparity in health outcomes. It's not only life expectancy, but infant mortality and other health outcomes by race and by income as well. And to say that as the country gets richer and richer, you know, our income 50 years from now as a country is going to be, you know, more than twice what it is today, and we're still going to have this, this should be the policy priority, not trying to adapt the Social Security system to something as outrageous as these kind of disparities.
Yeah, my feeling was he should have been addressing the root causes of this racial or class health disparity and addressing that rather than adopting Social Security to meet this as an inevitable consequence of being black or poor in America.
No, I agree completely.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for the call. I'm really glad the caller raised the point because I guess it was my understanding that if you take a look at life expectancy of African Americans, that as I think as you and the caller sort of suggest, part of the problem is the number of African Americans who die young. And if you actually look at those who manage to make it to 65, then the difference between them and white Americans in terms of how much longer they live and what sort of benefits they might expect to receive from Social Security, there's very little difference, actually.
Well, it's not trivial. It's still, you know, 2 years, which is quite a lot out of, I don't know, say 17 or 19, whatever, you know, you're going to expect at that age. So it's still significant, and it's also significant. You don't have to just look at 65, right? Because somebody who's paid into the system and dies earlier at 40 or 45 or whatever is still going to lose out more than somebody who lives into their 60s and 70s. So it is a disparity in the system. But as the caller noted, and I tried to argue as well, the problem is the life expectancy, and not just the and that's the real problem. It's not the Social Security system.
Mm. Let's talk with again another caller, Bloomington, Indiana, line two. Hello.
Hi, I've got a couple of questions. I understand the ratio of taxpayers to Social Security recipients is shrinking, and. And that shrinking ratio of taxpayers to recipients is actually it's constantly getting worse. So it seems to me at some point that shrinking ratio of taxpayers to recipients has got to put Social Security in trouble. And I got another question for you.
What? Yes. You want me to answer that one first?
Yeah, go ahead. Answer that first, then I want to ask.
Well, that's a good example. That's one of the things that's used, and I would call it a trick. You didn't mean it as one, but that's one of the tricks that's used. So you see these numbers, for example, that we have 3.3 workers for every retiree now drawing benefits, and now in 30 years from now it's going to be 2.1, for example.
Yeah.
Which is true. But the problem is that's just kind of like one half of a baseball score. You know, it's like saying the Orioles had a bad game. They only scored two runs and not mentioned the other side didn't score any. You see, what happens over time, over 30 years like that, is that productivity goes up as well. And as a matter of fact, even by the pessimistic projections of the trustees, over that next 30 years, productivity will go up by about 68 or 70%. You see, you don't need as many workers per retiree. This has been going on, again, all throughout the century. Another way to think about it is, you know, go back to 1870 when we had half the population in agriculture, half of the labor force was in agriculture, and now it's about 1%. But we're still feeding everybody. In fact, we're producing a lot more. So you see, over time, those changes don't have anywhere near as much impact. When you have to take into account both sides of the equation, the revenue and the payouts.
Increase in productivity doesn't mean that there won't be a higher tax on each worker.
Well, yeah, there will be a higher tax if we want to maintain the present system and we want to maintain the, you know, we want to live more years in retirement. This is what we did in the past. We did raise the payroll tax, as I said, in the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. And in each of those decades, those increases were less than what we would need over the whole next 75 years to keep the program solvent and pay all promised benefits. But that's the way Social Security works. It pays a benefit for as long as you're alive. That's why you can't outlive your payment. That's why it's called Social, that's why. Yeah, it's security. That's the security part of it, right? You don't outlive your payment.
Let me ask my second question. My second question is about the Democrats. When the Democrats were in power, they projected that Social Security would be in trouble at about the same year that the president now says that it'll be in trouble. And so some of the same Democrats who are now claiming that there is no problem with Social Security, when they were in power, they were saying that there would be a problem, and they were projecting about the same problem our president is.
Well, you know, that's true. You know, we're nonpartisan here at CPR, so I don't have any problem admitting that. I think that was one of the mistakes and one of the problems. And, you know, as I said, over the last 15 years, the country has been misled and misinformed very enormously. And you have to blame the press for that as well, because they shouldn't just take something as true simply because both parties are saying it for different political reasons. I think during the 90s, the Clinton administration, in the late 90s especially, they wanted to use Social Security to beat the proposed tax cut. And so they would say things like, we need the money to save Social Security and things like that. And it wasn't true. Again, the numbers are the numbers. Everybody's using the same numbers. It's just a question of how you misrepresent them.
Okay. But thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, and our guest is Mark Weisbrot. He is an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., that are interested in promoting debate on economic and social issues that affect people's lives. That's what it says on their website. If you're interested in learning more about the Center, reading some of Mark's work, looking at some of the papers that they have published on Social Security, other issues, if you have internet access, you go to their website, which is www.cepr for Center for Economic and Policy Research, cepr.net. Other questions are welcome. We'll try to take as many as we can in the time that remains. The next caller here in line would be in Champaign and on line one. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if you could compare your analysis with that of Lawrence Kotlikoff's, who makes a pretty careful prediction that Social Security and medical insurance programs cannot continue at their current levels.
Well, sure. I don't want to speak for him, but I have read his work. And again, the trick here is to throw in the medical costs, right? So you could say, you know, the Pentagon and medical costs, or highways and medical costs, whatever you want to mix with medical costs. As long as you got the medical costs in there, you've got an explosive problem, because medical costs are rising at an explosive rate. So there's the real crisis. You know, we spend twice as much as the other developed countries on healthcare, and we still have, you know, a sixth of our population uninsured. There's a real serious problem there, and that is going to have to be addressed. But again, it's not the Social Security part of it.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. To the next caller, this is someone in Chicago, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. A number of points. The current issue of the American Prospect magazine, I don't know whether it's the February or the March issue, but it's the current one, treats the Social Security problem in most of its issue, a complete section on it, about 20 pages or more. So anyone who's interested in a full coverage might read that, with your book, of course. Another thing is that the question was raised: why did the Democrats support some of this weakening of the Social Security system? If you follow politics closely, you can only you can only look at the Clinton and the Carter administrations as being not much different from Rockefeller Republicans as far as their politics were concerned, even though the Republicans paint them as flaming liberals, both Carter and Clinton. They were essentially a conservative day, and the Democratic Clinton essentially, with his group, controlled the Democratic Party and took them to the center or to the right, so that there's a very small percentage of Democrats who are really, say, Fair Deal or New Deal liberals. One more thing, and this is a major thing. You can't avoid asking the question when you look at this whole problem of Social Security and health care, and the position that the Republicans have taken, just why are the Republicans lying about the whole situation, and why their niggardly attitudes with regard to this and other New Deal and Fair Deal programs? And you can only conclude that the Republican Party exists to maintain and increase the wealth of the wealthy. And you reduce these programs and you reduce the tax on the Republicans, the very wealthy, and leaving the poor and the middle class in the lurch. And this essentially is your politics. It's a matter of who controls what and why and how. And that's the only way to approach the whole problem of politics, political science, and all that sort of thing.
Well, you want to comment on that, Mark?
Well, I think it is true that most of the changes that we've seen, certainly in the first Bush administration, have been redistributive and upwardly redistributive. Certainly the tax cut, the bulk of, you know, the biggest part of it, you know, nearly a third of it, or more than a third of it, went to people with incomes over $1 million a year, for example. And the Bush administration is proposing, I don't know if they're going to put this on their agenda or not, if they'll get past Social Security reform, but they've got proposals to do even more upward redistribution through the tax code. For example, eliminating the exemption for health insurance that people have now, and then increasing tax loopholes for upper income people to save more on their taxes. So definitely true. Although I have to say, this whole massive upward redistribution of income in the United States, which is the worst in the history of this country, has been going on for about 30 years now. And so some of it is, and the caller recognized this, bipartisan.
Social Security, I think, remains, in the minds of most Americans, a very popular program. And for that reason, in the past, politicians have been very hesitant to touch it at all. I think now there are even some Republicans who are not so sure about what the president is talking about. Do you think that it's likely that this is actually going to go anywhere, these reforms the president is talking about?
No, as I said, it is really only because they switched this big lie strategy about 15 years ago, and because most of the country is misinformed, that they have this chance. So a lot will depend on the media in two ways. I mean, one is press coverage has changed in the last few months. It's much different than it was a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 years ago, in the sense that at least half of it does mention that, for example, the program can pay all promised benefits for 38 or 48 years, which is a big thing. You usually had to read down to the bottom to find that out if you saw it at all. You do have more people now saying, well, there's no crisis, for example. You didn't have that a few years ago. When we wrote our book 5 years ago, it was much worse. The reporting was just atrocious. And so that's a big thing. I think the other place where the media is going to make a big difference here is if there's going to be defections from the Democrats, which the president could use in order to pass this, they're going to need political cover. So they're going to need the media to say things, which some of the media is actually saying, you know, that, well, the Democrats can't just say no to this. They have to come up with a plan. They have to compromise. They have to, you know, something has to be done.
Pardon me for jumping in there, Mark, but we're going to have to stop because we've used the time. We just want to say thanks very much again for being with us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Dave. It's always a pleasure.
Our guest, Mike Weisbrot, Mark Weisbrot, an economist at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. The program today made possible in part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe, downtown Urbana, for over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths. Birkenstocks from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff. Broadcast also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater. Information on the full line of Subarus available from Paul Moser and Kathy Wetherill, certified Subaru specialist. Their email is subaru@wardenmartin.com.